You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. Coming to you live from Studio One, I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Lebanon takes on new measures to control the flow of Syrian refugees.
One quarter of the population are refugees now, so it's understandable that they want to take measures to try to do this in an orderly fashion, and they don't want to see Lebanon totally overwhelmed.
Jim Hoare and James Schneider will tell us what this means for the continuing flow of displaced people from war-ravaged Syria. Then we'll meet Dame Evelyn Glynnie, one of Scotland's most revered percussionists, who also happens to be profoundly deaf.
I just felt that everything needed to be loud in order for me to hear it, but actually it really needed to be the complete opposite. So what I found was that if I took my hearing aids out, I could hear less through the ear, but more through the body.
We'll also check in with our correspondent in Bamako, and we'll review the latest art exhibitions in Italy. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
An Indonesian naval search and rescue ship returned to Surabaya today with parts of the wreckage of the Air Asia Airbus A320, which disappeared from radar screens on a routine flight a week ago. The warship Bung Tomo Asia also recovered bodies during its 1 week sailing off the coast of Borneo Island. The plane carrying 162 passengers crashed into the sea on the 28th of December, about 40 minutes after taking off from Indonesia's second largest city, Surabaya, for Singapore. There were no survivors. 37 bodies have been recovered and 13 identified. The United Nations has expressed concern over new Lebanese restrictions on Syrian refugees aimed at slowing the influx of asylum seekers escaping the civil war. The UN wants the government to clarify whether the most vulnerable refugees can still gain access to Lebanon. But UNHCR spokesman Ron Redmond is sympathetic to Lebanon's situation.
The government has made public statements the last few days, including the Minister of Social Affairs, that the previous practice of allowing extremely vulnerable people will continue. UNHCR is simply asking that we get something official in writing that will confirm that, and we'd like some information on exactly how the procedure will be carried out to ensure the most vulnerable people can still get in.
Here, a British nurse who was diagnosed with Ebola after returning from Sierra Leone is still in a critical condition but has stabilised, the Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt said, adding that Pauline Kafaki was getting the best possible care at the Royal Free Hospital in London. An emergency meeting of the Arab League has taken place to discuss the crisis in Libya as a Libyan warplane from forces loyal to the internationally recognised government bombed a Greek-operated oil tanker anchored off the coast, killing two crewmen in an escalation of hostilities between factions vying to rule the country. Hundreds of civilians have died in violence since August. The conflict has driven at least 120,000 people from their homes. Libya-based journalist Mary Fitzgerald says the violence has got worse in recent weeks.
Number of very serious escalations in recent weeks that have basically made international interlocutors, specifically the UN, very, very pessimistic about the chances of any meaningful dialogue, any meaningful negotiation to end this crisis anytime soon.
A former Tunisian interior minister has been nominated as prime minister to form a new government after an agreement among political parties. The nominee, Habib Essid, follows the election of Benji Kaid Essebi as president. But Monocle's reporter in Tunisia, Navina Kator, says the appointment has divided the public, with most thinking that Tunisia is still looking back.
We do have to wait and see what happens, but it is not a very encouraging sign that the people who are being appointed don't really seem to signal a sort of turning of the page, but more of a sort of turning back the clock.
And finally, last year was the UK's warmest since records began in 1910, the Met Office said. It was almost the warmest year in the Central England Temperature Series, which dates back to 1659 and is the longest running record of its type. The UK mean temperature for the year was 9.9 Celsius, 50 Fahrenheit, and 0.2 degrees higher than the previous record set in 2006. Last year's record means that 8 of the UK's top 10 warmest years have occurred since 2002. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06 and it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Jim Hoare, a former British diplomat based variously in Seoul, Beijing and Pyongyang, and James Schneider, editorial director at New African magazine. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start with Syria, where new controls in neighbouring Lebanon are aimed at restricting the flow of refugees across the border. Those fleeing the war-ravaged nation will now need to satisfy certain criteria before they're allowed a visa and entry into Lebanon. But with the flow of desperate and displaced people still as strong as ever, what will these new restrictions mean for those with nowhere else to turn? James, you know, when we look at the policies in the region, you have to feel some sympathy for Lebanon, a tiny, tiny country with over 20% of its population now made up from Syrian refugees, a country that's already failed in a past attempt to absorb many refugees from the Palestinian crisis, who many of still live in terrible conditions in refugee camps. What is Lebanon to do, really?
Well, you're completely right that Lebanon is kind of disproportionately forced to deal with this, you know, the terrible problem of refugees, and have had insufficient help from the rest of the world, both in terms of funding, but also in rehousing and settlement of refugees. They are able to reduce the numbers. I understand that the official figures, at least, have crossed the border, are down 75% from earlier on in the summer already. This has just been announced, which is stronger. It's been a gradual attempt to, reduce the amount of services that they will provide and make it seem like it's a less viable option for refugees to go for. But of course, the conflict is not stopping, and refugees are still going to cross the border one way or another. This in itself, and from what I've seen and from what I've heard, hasn't been a completely well thought through process. They haven't quite worked out how people who are already living in the country will have to go back to Syria in order to register, and you know what this will do for people who are there for work permits and all sorts of reasons. But we can see this as a sort of cry for help. They do require a lot more help in dealing with the problem, because they are the ones afflicted. If we think of the number of refugees that have come from Syria to all of Europe, it pales in insignificance in comparison to those who've gone into Lebanon.
Jim, when we again look at these numbers, they may have fallen since the summer. I see some reports suggesting that actually many of the people who are going to be displaced have now been displaced, and we're kind of dealing with those numbers. But on the West, it's a slightly short-sighted thing not stepping in to do more to help, because I imagine that the next stage of that migration process is those people then try to make it to Turkey, and then, as we've seen, on boats which wash up in the Med. Do you feel that, again, we should be doing more, to stop that, to help the people who are already in Lebanon, and therefore kind of hopefully help Lebanon stay as an existing country?
You mean keep the refugees out of Western Europe, which is basically what we tend to be concerned about.
Well, it's just striking that, you know, you get one boat washed up in Europe and it's on every front of every newspaper. Here's a country dealing with, you know, a million people crossing its border. It doesn't make a headline until they say, let's put a stop to it.
No, well, if a conflict comes closer to you, then you start taking attention to it, paying attention to it. I mean, I think this is another example of the West wanting to do things, wanting to do something to show that it's it takes seriously Syria or the rebellion in Syria, because the two factors contributing to the refugees, I would have thought. But when it comes to it, we don't want to take these people. It's the same problem with the large numbers that are gathering at Calais. It's the same problem with those you've mentioned, the boat people who are abandoned in the Mediterranean. They will ultimately want to flow on from Lebanon or wherever it is, and we don't want them. We, the governments, don't want them.
Well, I think the other question is even the government. You know, so we did a report recently about Sweden, which, you know, actually the Swedes are pretty good at taking the numbers. You know, they're going to take 100,000 refugees from Syria. But there's, you know, and even though they do their best, what actually happens is when people arrive in Sweden, they tend to be, you don't bump into many Syrians when you're in downtown Stockholm. That's because they end up in, you know, communities on the edges of the city, and their opportunities for entering Swedish society are still restricted for many of these people. So it's not even enough that we take the numbers. There just doesn't seem to be an, you know, James, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. Yes, Sweden should be applauded in the fact that it does actively seek out people fleeing conflict. But yeah, there's a huge problem of spatial segregation, and that demonstrates that one country is unable to do the kind of, you know, the full service on its own. What's really needed, and it's the same thing with refugee issues across the world. If you look at, for example, the Kenyan government that is desperately trying to stop Somali refugees coming into the country and wants to limit the amount of Somali refugees that are based in Kenya, it's the same thing. There is insufficient coordination globally, mainly by the countries that are most able to cope with it, because richer countries are the ones that don't get refugees. Or, you know, generally, refugees tend to go to countries that are bordering conflict.
Yeah, and the richer countries don't want a large influx of people who will be socially and economically disruptive.
But then, don't you think with Kenya, at least with there they have the option to kind of, you know, back the AU in Somalia and kind of go in and try and prop up a government that they believe in. Whereas in Syria, the kind of, we have our hands tied behind our backs in a sense, because, you know, no governments here were really, you know, the British public, for example, weren't willing to kind of see us topple the regime, the Assad regime. So yeah, the whole chain is, we're just kind of meddling along the whole chain.
Well, it's pushing the convention on refugees, you know, 60-year-old body of international law. It's pushing it to breaking point, because the countries that most have to deal with it are trying to push back and are trying to basically break the convention as much as they can, break their obligations on it, because they say they're just unable to honour them. And something has to be done at a global level, which involves, you know, whether politicians in Western countries, you know, like it or not, and for the short-term voter or whatever that may be, they're going to have to give a lot more.
You know, to me, it is another facet of the same problem we faced over the people from Eastern Europe coming to Britain over the last 12 months with the changes in the regulations, the EU regulations. Fine, we want freedom of movement until people actually start moving. And then we want control. And yet we're not, I agree entirely, we're not prepared to put the money that is required and the resources that are required to solve this problem.
We like freedom of movement when it means we can go to our holiday home in Spain, but that's about it.
Yeah, I fear that's what it is.
We're going to go to North Korea next, where the government has reacted with perhaps predictable outrage after the US increased sanctions against the nation. An unidentified North Korean spokesman said that the new sanctions would only strengthen its pursuit of a military-first policy. Of course, North Korea has been living with heavy sanctions for decades. Are we surprised by this move by the US? And can any level of sanctions really impact Kim Jong-un's grip on the nation? Well, Jim, I think this is one for you to start with.
It's not surprising the North Koreans have denounced it. They've said all along, it's not us. Most people seem to, certainly the United States government seems to believe it is them and is taking this action. I still think the evidence is pretty uncertain. But of course the North Koreans are going to react like this. You know, in the immortal words of the lady who died last week, they would, wouldn't they? I mean, like Mandy Rice Davis summed it all up. They're not going to let it pass. The sanctions themselves, as I understand it, are of very limited nature. They are not specifically targeted at any organisation that has been identified as carrying out the hacking.
So it's 10 key individuals,
isn't
it?
It's 10 individuals who are in military and intelligence fields, or supposed to be in military and intelligence fields, and I think three organisations that are also seen as somehow involved. Will they have any effect? Well, as you said, North Korea has been under sanctions since July 1950, since the outbreak of the Korean War. And that's really brought them to the negotiating table and led them to modify their policies, hasn't it? No, it has not. And the fact is that neither China nor Russia and nor other a number of other countries are actually implementing the existing sanctions. So quite what the effect these ones will have is pretty limited, I think.
James, you know, you cover a continent where we have the best example of sanctions actually working. You know, what happened to the apartheid regime of South Africa? Are you a sanctions believer?
Well, I mean, you've got to see them very differently in their context. I mean, sanctions, if they're what are called for by a movement working for social change within that country and they're amplifying and improving those, then yes, absolutely. If they're just sort of geopolitical posturing, which may inflict harm on the country itself, or may just be, about geopolitical posturing, then I'm far, far, far from convinced.
And Jim, isn't there, there's a bit of kind of almost like playground, politics going on here. And in a way, is it not too bad in a sense, that the Americans just want to annoy him? They just want to tweak his tail.
I think that there's a large element of that in it, that the Americans are very frustrated by North Korea, that they can't get them to do what they want. And so periodically they have another go at finding some measure to bring pressure. Frankly, I think the whole business of the way the issue of human rights has been taken up is much less to do with human rights than it is with getting at the North Koreans. And this is a similar sort of thing.
You've worked in Pyongyang.
I've worked in Pyongyang.
The people, you know the city. What is this? What is really going on here? What's your take on why these silly things kind of blow up into proper world, world-threatening events? Well, not quite world-threatening, they blow up from a stupid film into, we have, two governments now battling each other.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the problem with the stupid film is that it has a theme which sends shivers down North Korean spines, or worries down North Korean spines, that here is a film that appears to advocate the assassination of a country's leader. That seems to me to be very dangerous ground. It may seem comic and be seen as a humorous film in the West, but I noticed a report about North Korean refugees in the United States and in South Korea who'd watched the film, and they didn't find it at all funny. They couldn't understand why people thought it was a comedy, because they said, oh, you can understand why the North Koreans are upset. Here is the leader being parodied in this fashion. Here is a proposal to assassinate the leader. That worries people, or at least it gives them the opportunity to display fury and anger at the United States and at the people who have gone ahead with this.
Well, as you say, a country about which we know very little. And there was one intriguing story the last couple of days, which for me kind of put the spotlight on how ridiculous some of the coverage is. There was a story about, does he pluck his eyebrows too much? He's apparently been photographed with his eyebrows look smaller than they were a month ago. And there's some fear that he's been over-plucking his eyebrows. Well, there you go.
I don't think that's one of the world's great worries. But,
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Jim Hoare and James Schneider. When we return, we'll discuss sanctions against Russia and the latest turns in the campaign against military group Boko Haram. Stay tuned.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me is Jim Hoare and James Schneider. And now to more sanctions in a different part of the world. French President Francois Hollande has taken a different stance to many of his international counterparts by calling, potentially, for the lifting of sanctions against Russia. The move is, of course, conditional on whether progress is made in talks on the still raging conflict in eastern Ukraine. Jim, does it turn out that French principles have a euro price tag, do you think?
I'm not quite sure. I think it's not just France that's advocating this change. I mean, I think the BBC story listed a number of countries, including Italy and Germany, as having doubts about the whole sanctions move. The problem, I think, for many countries is that the Russians control the gas that provides the heating, and that means that the countries feel vulnerable, and so you're starting to get a feeling that, look, these sanctions aren't having any advantages for us. They're not solving the Ukraine problem. Perhaps if we were a bit nicer to the Russians, we might get a bit further. I tend to think there is something in that. I think the sanctions, again, I wish countries wouldn't sort of leap to sanctions for the reasons that James said earlier on, that, you know, unless there is a willingness within the countries themselves to have sanctions and so on, they don't work.
James, these sanctions, they looked, you know, over the last few weeks, I think there was some glee and some sense of schadenfreude as people saw the kind of ruble wobble and fall and the oil price collapse. It felt that, you know, the Russians were kind of getting their comeuppance. But as Francois Hollande's actions hint, the West is going to pay as well for a toppling of the Russian economy.
Yeah, but let's be clear.
It's not sanctions that have caused the oil price to drop. It's not sanctions that have caused the ruble to fall. It's oil price dropping that has caused the ruble to fall. And sanctions happen to be a kind of useful excuse at the same time. And part of the strategy that has been adopted by Putin since the sanctions first started coming in, because the sanctions are pretty targeted at key elements of finance, key ways that money is laundered through key individuals, using Western tax havens. And Putin moved to make them seem like they are more sanctions on the population with the sort of counter sanctions, i.e. the banning of foreign Western foods, to make it seem like the Russian economy, the real economy, as opposed to the Putin-associated oligarch economy, is really under attack from the outside. So I don't think we should necessarily overstate the role that sanctions have played. They are making it more difficult to refinance, but nowhere near as much as the slide in the ruble has done so. Hollande's move, I think we can see, we shouldn't read too much into it. I think what part of it is just, you know, we'll give a sliver of an opportunity and we'll see if Putin will jump. You know, now things are a bit more difficult for him because, as we said, the ruble has slid, the economy is going to contract severely. Will he do something? It doesn't necessarily have to be that honest. Europe is actually in a significantly stronger position with respect to Russian gas than we thought they were sort of 5 months ago. And then the other, a couple of other sort of smaller factors is the US and Canada, which have significantly stronger sanctions on key Russian individuals and companies than the EU has. It has been keeping up the pressure a little bit less. They've, focusing on other things. So they're forcing the Europeans to be less strong than they were. And I think there's possibly a small domestic element in that Hollande is trailing very much in the opinion polls to the pro-Putin candidate, to the far-right Marine Le Pen, who very much supports Putin. So there might be some small domestic political element in that. But I think it's, an opening in a very long series of negotiations, which is not going to stop soon.
Jim, we need to move on to Nigeria in a second. But just quickly, You're nice to Putin. I'm not sure. Do you think that really works in kind of winning him over? And you know, if you're kind of nice to Putin, isn't that just kind of giving up and saying, okay, you know, you've bitten off a large bit of Ukraine. We'll kind of forgive it. You know, we'll be nice to you now. We've had 4 months of kind of fussing after the downing of a Malaysian jet. Surely there's a point at which you do have to kind of hurt him in some way.
If you're prepared to take the consequences of that, yes, okay, you can do it. But, you know, you are risking a confrontation. And I think that nobody in Europe wants any sort of conflict with Russia. It's not just Western Europe either that whose economy has been affected. I mean, the whole of of the former Central Asian economies are badly affected. No Georgian, and the Caucasus as well. As no Georgian wines go into Russia anymore, no Georgian fruits, and that's having a devastating effect on Georgia.
I can see why you'd be the diplomat. I think you find it, it's a good central course. It's a difficult thing, but you know, we'll come back to the topic of Ukraine and Russia again. But now we're going to look at Nigeria, because today the northeastern Nigerian town of Baga has been seized by militant group Boko Haram, as well as a nearby military base. Witnesses reported that many people were killed and the town set ablaze. Many who survived the attack fled to neighbouring Chad after awakening to heavy gunfire as they watched multinational troops leaving the scene. James, you know, we've talked about Boko Haram many times. There's some idea that, you know, that there wasn't many international troops there at the time of the attack. Some people believing that this part of the country has almost been given up on. What do you think happened?
Well, from what can be understood from reports, and one of the main sources coming out for this is the senator for the region for Borno North, is that this town which hosts this multinational, so four countries joint task force, which was meant to be, or started off in 1998 as being a kind of anti-crime thing. There's a lot of smuggling that goes on around Lake Chad, which is where this town is, and it was transformed into an anti-Boko Haram force. And what we've been told is that the town was surrounded by three sides. The fourth side is Lake Chad this morning. And the military, just as they have done so many times, abandoned their posts. And we've heard that, it was mainly Nigerian troops who were there. And they received no backup. So there's an air base, I understand, about 45 minutes flight away. And the fighting went on for several hours and people were fleeing for several hours, and no air support was received by the military fighting there, or the civilians running away. So it's just, another and a really, really strong example of how the Nigerian military does not have this under control. The government doesn't have it under control, but it's not necessarily an issue of equipment and material. The Nigerian military should have sufficient equipment and material. It's it being in the right place with soldiers who feel like they have sufficient support that they will stand and fight. Because at the moment, in too many incidences, you know, Boko Haram come rolling into town, the soldiers disappear, the civilians get attacked, or the soldiers and the civilians are fleeing together, which again, from the reports from this, have come out that they were, you know, civilians and soldiers together were fleeing on canoes across the lake to get away from Boko Haram.
Jim, for the West, is there anything to do in this situation other than be, you know, sympathetic?
I really don't know very much about Africa. It's a long time, it's 50 years since I studied African history, though I did once. So I'm not sure that I really can contribute much. It seems to be, though, again, you have another refugee problem, a continuing refugee problem, and nobody outside the area seems to take responsibility for that. I think what's being described is a lack of will on the part of the government to take on these fierce fighters, or apparently fierce fighters, in remote areas, with feeling that the centre perhaps doesn't care, and that's a very difficult position to be in. The attention when the large number of girls were kidnapped that was very prominent in the Western media seems to have faded. And, you know, I'm sure this story will hardly make an impact in tomorrow's newspapers in Britain.
James, do you feel it is one of those things that, you know, it just felt too difficult for the West to get involved in? They don't know what to do. It is a problem that seemingly, you know, they can't actually kind of do anything to help the Nigerian government with.
Well, I mean, the West is involved. Both Britain and the UK provide a lot of military support, security, and have been doing so for many years. But sources in the security establishments in the US and the UK, that there's a limit to what they can do because it must be a Nigerian-led operation. And when there is problems at the top, it's difficult to see what kind of support. And anyway, the Nigerians have actually recently asked for the Americans to stop helping because they wouldn't sell them the right kind of helicopters that they wanted. So, I mean, yes, there should be as much, you know, Western support as they can give, but it must be a Nigerian or possibly regional or possibly AU-led force, which means leadership in Nigeria, you know, has to come up with the right policy and must be able to implement it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Jim Hoare and James Schneider, thank you very much for joining us today on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, we've got plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with our correspondent in Bamako and we'll review the new Italian exhibitions and lots more. But before we get started on that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much. An Indonesian naval search and rescue ship returned to Surabaya today with parts of the wreckage of the Air Asia Airbus, which disappeared from radar screens on a routine flight a week ago. The warship also recovered bodies during its 1 week sailing off the coast of Borneo Island. Here, a British nurse who was diagnosed with Ebola after returning from Sierra Leone is still in a critical condition, but has stabilised, the health secretary said, adding that Pauline Kafaki was getting the best possible care at the Royal Free Hospital in London. The UN has expressed concern over new Lebanese restrictions on Syrian refugees aimed at slowing the influx of asylum seekers escaping the civil war. The UN wants the government to clarify whether the most vulnerable refugees can still gain access to Lebanon. And an emergency meeting of the Arab League has taken place to discuss the crisis in Libya as a Libyan warplane from forces loyal to the internationally recognised government bombed a Greek-operated oil tanker anchored off the coast, killing two crewmen. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And Jonathan will, of course, be back in another 30 minutes with a fuller roundup of the global news. But welcome back to Midori House, which is live here on Monocle 24. And the time here in London is 18:32, which means it's 21:32 in Moscow. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And we're going to go to West Africa, where I'm joined by our woman in Bamako, Alex Duval-Smith. Happy New Year, Alex, and welcome to the show. We're going to start with a slightly tough story in the north of Mali. It seems that the situation there, the security situation, is worsening.
Worsening by the day. I mean, only this morning we had an attack in Nampala near the Mauritanian border in which at least three Malian soldiers were killed. Armed men in pickups drove into a very small army base and 20 others on motorbikes and just opened fire. It's the latest in what are now becoming daily reports of attacks either on the Malian army or by government militia or by any of the Tuareg or Arab secessionist groups, and indeed including Ansar Dine, who claimed responsibility a week ago for an attack on United Nations peacekeepers. So we've reached a crossroads now where I think the talks that are going on or have been going on in Algeria and are now at a standstill for the moment and we believe will resume at the end of the month are very much in the balance. I mean, I'm reporting pretty much everything except people fleeing the regions. That would be the most worrying thing if we started seeing a new influx of displaced people to the south of the country. But it is quite worrying.
Now, some months ago when we spoke, there was some kind of optimism that, you know, with the help of the French and a bit of fair wind, that the central government was actually doing a reasonable job at holding the country together. What's happened since then?
Well, a number of things have happened, including the fact that France has withdrawn from Mali, or rather has redeployed across five countries in the region. So the French troops, the operation that was called Serval is now rebaptized Operation Barkhane, and the French presence in Mali is largely limited to officers' detachments within the United Nations troops. So providing, if you like, the intelligence and the sharp end and some special forces as well that are here, but the French visible presence is much, much reduced, and the United Nations doesn't have the air power to cover or survey most of northern Mali. I mean, I was on patrol in Timbuktu recently and discovered to my horror that a day-long sweaty journey across dunes, we'd covered a round trip of 32 kilometers, because it's just, there are no roads, it's in impassable terrain, and yet between Timbuktu and the Algerian border there are 1,000 kilometers, and no one basically keeping an eye on them. And these are the trade routes, the hostage takers, favoured places, and they've regained confidence, and the Malian army hasn't come in and done its bit for sovereignty of the nations.
Now, in the early hours of Tuesday last week, there was reports of a potential coup against the Gambian president, and I see that two people have now been arrested in the US linked to this attempt. Now, we must point out that the president of Gambia himself kind of seized power back in 1994. I think he was only 29 years old at the time, so he knows the game. What do we make of these allegations?
Yes, indeed. Well, President Yahya Jammeh was out of the country when there was this supposed coup. It does appear that President Jammeh, though it's sometimes quite hard to believe what he says, on this occasion was right. He was claiming that it wasn't a military coup, but it was organized from the outside by opposition forces in the UK, in the US and Germany. President Jammeh has, as you say, he's been in power for 20 years and he's weathered a number of coup attempts. He's become increasingly autocratic. He's also known for his somewhat erratic behavior and strange announcements, like in 2007 he announced that he could cure AIDS. Amnesty International don't approve of his human rights record, including the fact that he jails gay people for life. And yet, the Little Gambia, which is jammed in the middle of Senegal, is a major tourist destination for northern Europeans, and I think a place it's worth keeping an eye on. What happened last week was an exchange of gunfire, three people supposedly killed. The government said that the people attempting to overthrow the president had arrived by sea. All sort of sketchy information, and we don't really know what to believe, except, as you say, the most recent report is of two people having been arrested in the United States.
Now, the US has deployed a new kind of vessel off Africa, a lightweight troop carrying catamaran. This is called the Spearhead, and I think you've been to see it.
Yeah, well, it caught my imagination. I haven't been to see it, actually, but I've been sent a little film about it, and it's been deployed off the coast of Nigeria. It's just an intriguing vessel, a bit like, I think there have been in the past, catamaran cross-channel ferries. They travel a lot faster than ordinary old-fashioned ferries, and this is a massive catamaran, 2,500 tons of aluminium, 300 feet long. It looks rather like a sort of low-lying ferry with two knife-like hulls plunging into the sea. It costs $120 million and can carry a fully operational tank, for example, or 500 troops. And so basically this is the US, United States, taking an interest, obviously, in oil in Nigeria. The United States depends, has a strong dependence on Nigerian oil, and there's a lot of trouble in the Niger Delta. Also looking at illegal fishing, supporting the Nigerians in that respect, and deploying this vessel, which has the beauty of being massive but also being quite fast. It can travel at up to 35 knots, which is pretty good for a seagoing vessel that size.
So is it a US Navy ship that's working on behalf of the Nigerian government off its coast?
It's entirely US. It just happens to be off Nigeria and available to support the Nigerian Navy, which in itself is quite lacking in vessels and facilities. It's actually operated by something called the Military Sealift Command, who are a sort of cross-service unit of the US Navy, and can be used to transport both equipment and troops and to intervene very quickly. So one expects it to be deployed around the coast of Nigeria, probably ostensibly to check on illegal fishing activities in support of the Nigerian Coast Guard, but also, of course, to keep an eye on the oil rigs.
Now, Gabon's president is known for liking to have a few possessions, and it seems he owns a whole Geneva Motor Show of cars.
He does, and I just couldn't help thinking of my motorcade, which is a regular read of mine in Monaco. This is just a motorcade that presents itself to you. In 2010, 4 months after Ali Bongo became president, taking over from his father, a Swiss company called SDP Service sold £10 million worth of luxury vehicles, including two Maybaches, two Rolls-Royce Phantoms, two Rolls-Royce Silver Ghosts, to the government of Gabon. And apparently they sit, and this has become known through France 24 television, who have obtained the receipts, and they're sitting in this huge garage in Libreville. And it would appear that the president doesn't even know how many cars he's got. You know, there are at least 400 luxury vehicles in this 1,000-metre square parking lot, and a sort of VIP reception area, which includes apparently a €6,000 Fernando Alonso helmet, also surrounded by other Ferrari memorabilia.
Sounds like he's got good taste.
In a country where a third of the population is below, you know, survival levels, one should add.
I like the fact that he bought two of everything. I hope he got kind of two for the price of one deal from his Swiss friends. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Alex, as ever. That is, of course, Alex Duval-Smith, who is Monocle's correspondent in Bamako. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we're going to hear an interview with one of the world's most prominent percussionists, Scottish musician Dame Evelyn Glennie.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. With bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents, Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, one of the world's leading percussionists, the Scottish musician Dame Evelyn Glennie, is profoundly deaf. She lost her hearing at the age of 12, but rather than letting that isolate her, she gradually found a new, different kind of connection to music. Monocle's Thomas Lewis travelled to Cambridgeshire to meet Dame Evelyn, and here she discusses how she grew up around music.
Well, here we're in a room full of instruments, and we've just passed a traditional instrument of South Korea called a chango, which is like an hourglass drum, very beautiful indeed. There's also a set of exhaust pipes on a very crude homemade stand. And
did you make that? Or
absolutely, those were the ones I played for on when I collaborated with Björk, and on a piece called My Spine. And we're coming to a very large, long instrument called an amadinda. And this is like an African marimba. And you'll notice that actually it's much, much lower in height than a Western concert marimba. So if I just go down to the low end where the mallets are.
Thank you.
What a sound.
It is amazing, actually, and it goes right to the top there, and it's quite distinctive because it creates this sort of buzz-like sound. So each resonator, which basically consists of gourds, have a little hole in them with rice paper, and sometimes you use snake skin to cover the hole. It depends, but this is a little bit of paper, and so it creates that slight buzz to the sound.
And how have you transported all of these instruments from all over the world? Like, has it been a lifetime's collecting as well as playing, I suppose?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been collecting instruments for so many years now. And obviously, I was able to transport a lot of them before the days of, paying for luggage and things like that. So I'm quite amazed, actually, of some of the things that I was able to travel back with. But and of course, nowadays with the internet, you know, you can find a lot of unusual things there. But I still like the fact of coming across things as I'm traveling around, because then the instruments have a particular story. They have, I think, greater meaning than buying them on the internet.
Absolutely. I can empathise with that. Definitely. When you were 8 years old, you began to lose your hearing. And by the age of 12, you were being supported by hearing aids. And today you describe yourself as being profoundly deaf. How did you begin to notice that things were changing?
Well, really, I had very sore ears whenever I went outside. And of course, being a farmer's daughter, you know, and growing up on a farm, I was always outdoors. And it became really quite unbearable. And so I found that I was inside more. And that was really the time when I was just sort of playing around on the piano, exploring with the piano. And I found that when I heard a lot of sound, it became noise. And I couldn't quite decipher, you know, where the sounds were coming from. Now, when you're so young, you don't think, oh, you're going deaf. You know, you're just finding a way to function, really. And then I went through for years and years a series of tests, really, as I was growing up to make sure the hearing aids were the right type and so on, and the right strength and all sorts of things. And I remember I had to wear a phonic ear, which is a very old-fashioned thing nowadays, but that was very helpful. But what I found was that whenever I started playing in the school orchestras, it was becoming a very painful experience because all the noise was just becoming this wave of sound, almost like a wall or block of sound. So I just felt that everything needed to be loud in order for me to hear it, but actually it really needed to be the complete opposite. So what I found was that if I took my hearing aids out, I could hear less through the ear, but more through the body. And this was really discovered when my percussion teacher at school said, well, Evelyn Heavens, this timpani, this really resonates. You know, can you feel that? And we experimented with where we're feeling it. And he said, if that timpani can resonate, maybe the human body can too.
And there's a wonderful picture that you paint where I believe it's the same teacher would have you place your hands on a wall and then would play various timpani instruments.
Different pictures, yes.
Exactly. Describe what that process would like.
Well, it was just literally that. My teacher asked me to place my hands on a wall and, you know, the walls were extremely thin. And he had two timpani there, or kettle drums, and they were tuned to different pitches, so quite wide intervals apart. And he would strike one drum and he would ask, Evelyn, where are you feeling that? And I would say, well, I'm feeling it from this part of my hand to close to my fingertips or something. And then he would play the other drum with a different pitch. And again, where would I be feeling that? And so I said, well, actually, I feel that only on this part of my hand. And it went on like that. And he would lessen the interval so that the pitches became closer and closer and closer. But yet you could feel that difference. So, and that really, really made me pay attention, not just to the actual strike on the drum, but the journey of that sound. So how long was I feeling it through my hand or through my neck, my chest, my cheekbones, whatever the instrument may have been? You know, how long am I actually feeling that resonance? And that was a huge turning point, because that then affected when I'd place the next sound, when I was actually playing the music myself. It made me become a far better listener, a more attentive listener, a more patient listener, I think.
Well, that was the Scottish musician Dame Evelyn Glennie speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis. You're listening to Dory House, and let's continue with a bit of music. And here is Evelyn Glennie and the National Philharmonic Orchestra with Rodeo Hoedown. How good was that? Shall we play it again? Well, no, we can't, I'm afraid. We have to end the show. That was... Ooh, I think we need to have her back again tomorrow. Anyway, that was Rodeo Hoedown by Dame Evelyn Glennie and the National Philharmonic Orchestra. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And it's time now for our daily arts review. And today we're going to take a look at Italian art. Well, art on in Italy, actually. And joining me on the line now to discuss this further is Luca Mastrantonio, journalist at Corriere della Sera, the Sunday cultural supplement thereof. Now, we're going to start, first of all, with the Eve Klein exhibition, which has just opened in Milan. And tell us about this. Luca, how good is this exhibition?
Hello, hi to everybody. It's a good dialogue between the exhibition is dedicated to Eve Klein and Luciano Fontana. So it's a sort of double between Milan and Paris in the middle of the last century. And with a creative plot between these two artists, we have 90 paintings and sculptures of this protagonist of the last century. In brief, in the middle of the last century, Yves Klein held his first solo exhibition in the Apollinaire Gallery in Milan, and Lucio Fontana was the first buyer of some works of the French artist. And then they make a sort of liaison artistique between between themselves. It's a good piece, a sort of double, because these two artists played against the space, and it's a hard match. Maybe they won sometimes, because the space is a theme taken by Fontana with the famous holes in the canvas, maybe someone remember, connecting different dimension of the space. And Klein used the famous blue dimension, a neon color who makes sleeping the shapes. And the dialogue is clearly observable with some words I can describe. One is the structure of neon suspended in the air made by Fontana, and the words of Yves Klein, that dialogue with the Fontana works, is the hypnotic blue expanse of pigment pure. And they were very impressed by the new discovering space out of the earth with the spaceship. And so it's a great dialogue, and I want to say that it's created by Silvia Bignami and Giorgio Zacchetti, and is open until March, and you can see it at Museo del Novecento in Milan, close to the Dome.
Well, Luca, that sounds great. Now, something else which is a bit of a kind of an arrival in Italy is the American Chronicles exhibition, The Art of Norman Rockwell, which is on in Rome. And I wanted to kind of get your view of this. So, because, you know, obviously Norman Rockwell is famous for his, you know, his kind of sugar-coated view of American family life, you know, the peak of, you know, the good times in America in the 50s. How do they sit when you look at those images as an Italian, or when they come to Italy? You know, Italy in the 1950s was experiencing a very different world to Italy. It had just come out of the Second World War. The country was, you know, pulling itself back together. How do those images look to an Italian?
Just like sugar, because... Especially now, because now it's sugar for the middle class in crisis, also in Italy. And maybe it was the dream, the American dream that we wanted after the war. It's so sweet because it's realistic. I mean, for Italy was just in the middle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And maybe we can define the Italian impression of Norman Rockwell just like a mixing between the Walt Disney way, a sweet way of seeing the reality, and the social realism of the East Europe. So maybe Italy is a good place to look to Norman Rockwell, because now it's a past dream, but I like it, and it's the first big exhibition in Italy, and now there's a sort of sensuctis, a sort of melancholia for Italian middle class to see the first strike of the American dream, like it's by Norman Rockwell portrayed in a great way. He was the people artist, and maybe was also the Italian people artist, not just in the middle of the last century, but after when we have an economic boom, especially in the 16 years.
And obviously many Italians got on the boat and went to America. Now, we don't have much time, Luca, and I just wanted to catch up with the very last exhibition, a touring exhibition which we've all heard much about, the Body World exhibition. This is, of course, you know, the stripped back real bodies that's produced by Gunther von Hagens. It's come to Rome, and you know, we've talked much about this in the past. Does it have much merit? Is it exciting people? Surely Rome was a city that could almost have done without it, or do you actually like this exhibition?
Yeah, to be very, very fast. I mean, I hope Rome was a good city for this Baroque exhibition, but I really don't like it. And it's the first time I think I now understand Virgans, because seeing all this flesh, and I hate the waxworks, but the bodyworks are without the alibi of being fake. So I will not recommend to see it in Rome.
Well, and of course, you've got Leonardo da Vinci. He understood more about how the body works than old Gunther von Hagens. Well, thank you, Luca, very much for joining us. That was, of course, Luca Mastrantonio, who is a journalist at Corriere della Sera, and a fine guest he was too. But that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the hour, Jim Hoare and James Schneider. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie and Ben Ryland, and it was researched by David Pleasant and Claire Lancaster. And our studio manager
That, of course, was Bill Luty. Next, after the headlines, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. Then at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily with Ted Kravitz and Marcus Hippie. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is, of course, 1800 hours. But from me, Andrew Tuck, time to say goodbye.